Excision number 11909, Reel 1.
Mr. Gold, Reel 1. When and how did you come to join the West African Force, please?
I joined them in the spring of 1943, having been called up in 1940 and done my training in the Scots Guards at Chelsea Barracks, subsequently at Purbright at the training battalion. I went to OCTU at Pekele and was commissioned in the spring of 41 into the Argonne and Southern Highlanders. After two or three months with their 11th Battalion, I was transferred to the 70th Young Soldiers Battalion, which was at that time spread over the aerodromes in the north of Scotland doing aerodrome defence work. This carried on for about 18 months, and on the disbandment of the Young Soldiers Battalion, the 70th Battalion of the Argylls, consequent upon the taking over of their duties by the RAF regiment, I was transferred along with two or three other officers to the Lovett Scouts, who at that time were stationed in the northern extremities of Scotland at Halkirk in Caithness.
What were they like?
They were a very efficient unit. It was obvious to those of us who joined them that they were a close-knit, almost a family unit. The officers were local lairds, sometimes titled ones, and most of the privates and the other ranks were drawn from the gillies and workers on the estates. Consequently, it was, as I say, very much a tightly knit unit. I was only there, however, for about 3 months, because in the spring of 1943, officers were required for overseas posting to the West African Royal West African Frontier Force, which was forming then for sailing to the east. And I, along with these other two officers who had joined the battalion at the same time, were amongst those posted to the RWAFF. We arrived in Lagos in the spring of 1943 and did some preliminary training. I joined the 5th Battalion of the Gold Coast Regiment. We did some preliminary training in the back country in Nigeria, near a place called Abeokuta. And by August of 1943, we sailed round the Cape and landed in India at Bombay.
Can I just interrupt you there and ask you what your impression of the troops with the Gold Coast Regiment was?
Well, it was, of course, quite a surprise and a change to those of us who had been accustomed to living and working with British troops. But speaking for myself, it didn't take me long to adjust to the different conditions. The situation in the West African Frontier Force was that all the officers and senior NCOs were, as they were then called, European. In other words, they were white. And the junior NCO ranks and the private soldiers were black. Now, there were a wide variety of types of soldier in the West African Frontier Force, in the Gold Coast Regiment, as in any others. There were some who had got a certain amount of education, who were literate, and they usually filled the jobs in the company headquarters officers and also rose more readily, I suppose, to the ranks of corporal and sergeant. On the other hand, the boys from the bush, as we used to call them, were totally illiterate. They, let us face it, didn't really know much of the deeper purposes of the war at all. They merely did what they were told. But as we found later in action, their performance equated precisely to their opinion of the British officer who was in charge of them. In other words, if they thought he A, didn't know much of what he was about, or B, was a little bit diffident, for want of a more unkind word, they were very little use themselves. But if they thought that the officer was prepared to undertake the risks that they did and knew what he was doing, they would follow him through thick and thin.
What was the tribal composition of the battalion?
They all came from the tribes of the Northern Territories, a variety of them, largely Moshis and Dagombas, quite a few Farafara. At this long remove, I can't remember all the various ones. There were from the Basari, it's difficult to think of any others, but they were mostly Moshis and Dagombas. They were the tribe that seemed to produce the most material.
Why was that?
Well, I think they were probably the most numerous, and possibly those nearer what was then regarded as civilization. Because you must remember that in the 1940s, the Northern Territories were still fairly undeveloped.
Why were Southerners not recruited?
Good question. Why were Southerners not recruited? There were quite a few, and the more educated or partly educated types, the ones that used to be referred, not necessarily in a derogatory way, but used to refer to as savvy boys, they did come from the Gold Coast colony itself, which is the coastal area, and the Ashanti, which is the immediate hinterland. But they were, in fact, not so numerous, possibly because they had been the subject of the first intake. I got there in 1943. They had been recruiting since about 1941. And it was only these three battalions, my battalion, the 5th, the 7th and the 8th, who formed a part of what became the 81st Division. But there were other troops which, as far as I'm aware, had been training but didn't actually leave the Gold Coast or Nigeria colonies. And probably they took most of their intake from the southern element, the Gold Coast colony and the Ashanti. It was only that we took a very large number from the Northern Territories because they were probably combing further afield to get material.
So the Southerners weren't regarded as unsoldierly material?
Not unsoldierly, no. No, they were useful for those tasks requiring a certain amount of mental effort and ability. The Northern Territory boys, who, as I say, were largely quite uneducated, a few of them could read and write, but the majority couldn't, they were extremely useful for that particular type of work which, in the West African units, differed totally from the normal British and indeed Indian units. When we were in action, we had no transport at all. All our equipment and loads had to be carried by our own troops and their bearers as headloads. And we had to have fellows who were really pretty tough, although not particularly bright in the mental sense.
What were their strengths and weaknesses as soldiers? What type of things would they excel in and not excel in?
They were extremely good in that very important part of jungle warfare, which I suppose, for want of a better phrase, I can only call bushcraft, that they understood how to move, and they were excellent at moving in undergrowth, in thick undergrowth. They were much more acutely aware of other unusual sounds, indeed hostile troops possibly, than we as Europeans by nature were, although of course our training, which was clearly greater than theirs, helped to some extent. But they were naturally good at detecting hazards in the jungle.
Were their senses, like eyesight and hearing and so on, superior to yours?
I would say so, yes. Yes, I would say so. And their movement was better, too. They could move more quietly. The British troops had to adjust, of course, but many of us found it not easy to move noiselessly through thick bamboo jungle, which is what we had to do.
Were they good marksmen?
As in a British unit, some were and some weren't. They mostly knew what they were doing, but they did rather have a habit, by and large, of emptying their whole magazine as quickly as they could in the direction of the enemy, instead of picking them off quietly. But no, they, as I said at the beginning, their behaviour and their efficiency depended largely upon their view of the officer in charge of them. If they had confidence in the officer, they usually performed just as well, if not more valiantly, than their white counterparts.
Did you have any disciplinary problems with them?
I personally didn't. One of my colleagues, who better be nameless, and who throughout the entire campaign had personally nothing but, I have to say, contempt for the men under him, didn't get on so well because they appreciated this very quickly. This type of attitude, I'm glad to say, was completely the exception rather than the rule. And no, the only time that I heard in our division, in fact I was slightly involved in our division, of any disciplinary problems was when a battalion of the Sierra Leone regiment had some problems which were dignified by the title of mutiny. It wasn't quite that. It wasn't in action, it was in at base camp, but they refused to carry out their orders, and there was a wholesale court-martial on the border of which I was.
How were you on the border of it?
We had seven officers on the court-martial, and I was one of the seven who had, if you like, the misfortune to be nominated by my battalion.
When was this?
This was when we had come. It was after technically the end of the war. It was in the November-December of 1945, when we were at base camp waiting for arrangements to be made to ship the troops back to West Africa and to go home ourselves.
What was the source of the trouble?
Oh dear, it's a long time back and I can't remember the full details, but I think it was an auxiliary group which consisted entirely of carriers, and not therefore a fighting unit, and they refused to to carry out, shall I say, their duties, and more or less just said no to the officer when he gave them an order, and the ringleaders were put in into the guard room, and it was, as it always is in these matters, a long time before this was brought to the table, as it were, and I can't honestly remember. I had to withdraw from the court-martial because my unit was going back and I was replaced, but as far as I know, nothing very serious was done in the way of punishments. They were reprimanded and so forth, but nothing further than that. But this was the only example we had of serious lack of discipline.
Had it been an unreasonable order?
I don't think so. I think it was possibly largely owing to a misapprehension, and partly there was there undoubtedly the element of dissatisfaction, but basically I think over conditions and the fact that the men felt that it was high time they went home.
What kind of people were the ringleaders?
They were all illiterate and uneducated generally, because being, as I say, carriers and bearers, they had the more menial jobs, and consequently they would not be the educated ones.
Coming back to that brother officer of yours whom you mentioned had trouble, what kind of disciplinary trouble did he have?
It wasn't discipline in trouble, because there was no refusal of orders, but the West Africans had a very simple way of showing that their heart was not in it. Instead of looking cheerful and laughing and being cheery all the time, they carried on, I suppose, in a British context, we would call it dumb insolence. They did what they were told to do, but they did it sullenly. And this, I'm afraid, was very very apparent in the troops that he had with him. But no breach of discipline in that case, that we knew of, anyway.
Were they valorous troops?
On the whole, yes. On the whole, yes. They had a large number of military medals and distinguished conduct medals and so forth, in proportion to their numbers. And yes, they were. Most of them behaved with considerable courage.
Were they smart?
In the course of action Off duty, they could get they could make themselves quite smart. I'm afraid that marching through the jungle, one tends to get rather tatty. Anyway, so I wouldn't like to say it in the course of action they were smart, but then that wasn't really so necessary.
Just coming back to the court martial,
yes,
said
indeed.
A base. Where was the base?
This was at Madras.
What do you think the motivation of the African troops was in your unit? What impelled them to perform well as soldiers?
Very difficult to say. As I think I suggested just now, many of them hadn't a clear idea, in a global sense, of why they were there. They just knew that they were helping the Baturi, as they call them, let's say the foreigners, that's us, in a job they had to do. I don't think many of them, the more intelligent ones, certainly would. For instance, one of the officers in the only black officer in our brigade was far more intelligent than any of us. When he had a period in hospital and he asked for some books, which I offered to get for him, he said he'd like to have some of the works of Homer and Thucydides, which shook me rather, and I'm afraid it also shook our library, which couldn't produce it. But he was a great exception, obviously, and he subsequently became the Ghanaian ambassador to Great Britain. But he was, at that time, in the 1943-4, he was an officer in the 5th Brigade of the 81st Division.
What do you think the attitude of the Gold Coast troops was towards the Japanese enemy?
They hated them. There's no doubt about that. I don't know by what motivation, but they had certainly been inculcated with a very, if you like, healthy hatred and I wouldn't say contempt, because they hadn't any grounds for contempt, but certainly of hatred of the Japanese enemy.
Do you know why that should have been so?
Only I can suggest that they've been given a good dose of propaganda, perhaps, from our educational officers and staff. I don't know, other than that, why, no. You must realise that I don't think most of them, certainly not the ones under my command, thought very deeply on these matters. It was an instinctive feeling in most cases.
Was there any sense of serving Britain or the king or anything of that
yes,
kind?
Yes, yes. Certainly amongst those who did indulge in considerable thought processes, and there were some, certainly amongst them, I think the idea of serving the king over the water, so to speak, was quite pronounced, yes, I would say. They realised that they were sort of doing their duty, however nebulously it might have been envisaged.
Was there any sense of regimental pride in the Gold Coast?
Oh, yes. Oh, definitely, definitely that. As you know, we had in the 81st Division four different colonies. Nigeria, which was by far the most numerous, Gold Coast, Sierra Leone and Gambia, and there was a sort of rivalry between them, mostly friendly rivalry, but a rivalry between them, certainly to do as well or better than their colleagues.
Did tribal differences cause any problems to you?
There was an underlying element there, yes. I can't recall, to my knowledge, any specific incidents where real bad blood was evidenced, but there was a lot of inbuilt feeling of I'm a Moshi, you know, he's only a Farafara, this sort of thing, and it took me some time to appreciate that, and then I tried to play it down. For the latter part of my service, I was in charge of headquarter company, which had absolutely everybody in it. The educated boys who manned the office and the signals, and the other slightly sort of intellectual or slightly educated elements, motor transport and so forth. It also had the carrier platoon and the mortar platoon, which were needed the uneducated but very well-muscled bearers. So that, as I say, I had a good cross-section, but I was aware of the fact that sometimes tribal pride would rear its head, but not to any disruptive degree.
Was there any sense that somebody in a position of power would favour his own tribe rather than somebody else's?
No, not within my experience. I'm not saying it couldn't have occurred. I'm sure it could, but not within my experience, because there weren't really many opportunities for that to occur within my orbit, anyway.
Whilst you were in West Africa with them, did they have families with them or nearby?
Oh, no, no. Not so far as the Gold Coast boys were concerned, because we joined, at least I joined, the 5th Gold Coast Regiment when it already had moved from Takoradi in Gold Coast to Nigeria, and it was actually training in Nigeria, so they were all several hundred miles away already from their homes and their families. No, I believe that when the regiments were being raised back in Gold Coast, there was a certain element of that, but certainly by the time I joined them in Nigeria, they were a long way from their families.
How did they take to being far away from home?
not greatly differently from the British attitude, a little bit more clearly expressed, I think, because they were, I'm not saying this patronisingly, but they were mentally a little bit more like children, and consequently their emotions were more obvious. But no, I don't think fundamentally they took this very differently from the British or European troops.
How dependent were you on your senior African NCO?
Quite considerably, because they also, the troops, regarded their African company sergeant majors and sergeants as models for them, in just the same way as, to a far greater degree, they regarded the British officers and NCOs as models. So, again, if you had a not-so-good African NCO, that would be reflected in the slight marking down of efficiency amongst the troops, too. So they did depend quite considerably upon their NCOs.
Were you in charge of a company?
To begin with, in the first campaign, I was in charge of a mortar section, which was attached to companies, to rifle companies, as required. I was a second in command of a rifle company at the beginning of the second campaign, and then took over headquarter company during that campaign, and remained in charge of headquarter company for the rest of my time out there.
How did your troops take to the voyage to the Southeast Asia?
Well, they were not, any of them, very good sea travellers, so they didn't enjoy the sea journey, particularly coming home. We went out round the Cape and up the Indian Ocean to Bombay, but coming home, of course, after the war was over, we came back through Suez Canal, and I'm afraid they found that the sea passage through the, particularly through the Aegean, at the other end of the Mediterranean, most uncomfortable for them. They were not good sailors, but they were so glad at that time to be getting back that I think they rode that in their stride.
Did they show much curiosity about your own origins and what life was like in Britain, or did they never ask you questions about it?
No, not much. They regarded all of us as their house of word was Baturi, in other words, incomers, foreigners, and that was not used as a derogatory sense, merely as an explanatory sense. And they accepted that. They may have thought, well, these people are rather odd, they come from overseas. But they never, the ones I spoke to, and I had a quite intelligent orderly and batman, and they were both of them Northern Territory boys, and they neither of them showed great interest to what went on in Britain or far overseas from them.
Was Hausa the lingua franca?
No, Pidgin English was really the lingua franca, very much of a sort of, instead of saying, be as quick as you can, they say, you go one time, that sort of thing. Occasionally, we were expected, but we had to use Hausa words to describe things. Their tent was their gidda, and the famous phrase was, oh,